Hi, welcome to another episode of the Human Intelligence Podcast from Riot IQ. I'm Dr. Russell T. Warren, the host and chief scientist at Riot IQ. And today my guest is Gilles Gignac, who is a researcher affiliated with the University of Western Australia. And we're here to talk about two really interesting articles of his related not just to human intelligence, but also to artificial intelligence too. The first one is called Defining Intelligence, Bridging the Gap Between Human and Artificial Perspectives. He co-authored this with Ava T. Svorodai. I should have asked in advance how you say her last name. We will provide a link to that article in the description. And the second one is called Psychometrically Derived 60-Question Benchmarks, Substantial Efficiencies and the Possibility of Human-AI Comparisons. And that's with David Illich. And again, we'll provide a link to that. So first one, we're going to talk about human artificial intelligence perspectives, and then we'll move on to how do you measure artificial intelligence and ask the intriguing question of can you even give an AI robot an IQ test? So thanks for being on the podcast. Thanks for agreeing to come on and talking about your research with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, tell me a little bit about your background and your interests as they relate to intelligence research so we can have some context for these studies.
Sure. So my name is Gilles Gignac, and to give a bit of background, I'm a French-Canadian originally. And I did start my education there, undergraduate university, and even started studying and researching intelligence even as early as my honors thesis. And then moved on to University of Western Ontario and worked with Tony Vernon. I don't know, Russell, if you remember Tony Vernon. Did a master's degree with Tony. We looked at information processing mostly. But then I met Con Stow at a conference in Cleveland and at the very first ISIR conference. And Con persuaded me to move to Melbourne, Australia to do research with him. Originally to do research on the psychopharmacological basis of intelligence, which was really interesting to me. I had been doing mostly psychometrics before then, but I had an interest in the biological basis of intelligence. But ultimately, I just slipped back into psychometrics, and I changed my thesis topic. Probably about 6 months into it, I changed it. And I've been doing research on psychometrics and individual differences ever since. An area that, you know, I'm quite passionate about and think is a very important area. And within individual differences, you know, I feel like intelligence is probably the most important dimension to research for a variety of reasons. I won't answer all that right now. But, you know, I work today as an associate professor in the School of Psychological Science at University of Western Australia. And I've been here for about, you know, 13 years.
Wow. I understand the pull of psychometrics. That's my first love and how I got pulled into the field too. So we have that in common. Let's talk about that first article, the Defining Intelligence article, where you talk about human and artificial perspectives. What was your goal in writing this article?
Well, it was a big goal. I have to say it was with some trepidation that I thought I would try to publish a paper on defining intelligence. If you were to go to conferences in intelligence, people have pretty strong opinions about what it is and what it isn't. And to try to publish something in a journal like Intelligence and defining it, you know, I knew I was up against it. But I also felt like the area of AI was making a lot of strides, and they were wrestling with the same challenge, you know, what is intelligence? And I noticed that they weren't really looking a lot at the psychological literature. They were kind of just starting from the ground up. But, you know, we knew already quite a bit about intelligence, I would say, before artificial intelligence. And I thought I could write a paper that computer scientists could read to help understand intelligence from a human intelligence perspective. But also human intelligence researchers, I thought, were not really paying a lot of attention to AI at that point. I would even say still today, it's not huge. I think it's in front of people, but they're not researching it per se. And I thought I could write a paper that might also help human intelligence researchers think about AI. And then ultimately, the main goal of the paper was to introduce this idea of artificial achievement and artificial expertise as distinct from artificial intelligence. And I wanted to work through that and help people understand the distinction and why it's important.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up because it really is much more than an artificial intelligence paper. And you make these distinctions between, okay, let's talk about intelligence as a capacity to think and problem solve, but let's also talk about what I think in the human psychology perspective we would call maybe skills or achievement. And that's a distinction I had never seen anywhere else in all the chatter about AI. So that's why the paper caught my attention. That's why I wanted to talk about it here on the podcast. In that paper, you define intelligence as, and I'm quoting here, a human's maximal capacity to achieve a novel goal successfully using perceptual cognitive processes. Now first I'm going to ask you, for our audiences, some of whom are not human intelligence researchers, what does that mean? What do you mean by a capacity to achieve a novel goal through perceptual cognitive processes?
I suppose what I'll mention before I even get there is that previous definitions, like Godfrinson, for example, would list, they would say it's the ability to reason, remember things, learn, etc. And they would basically list a series of dimensions that are often tested in intelligence. Mm-hmm. But I felt like that a list of dimensions is not really a definition of a construct. I describe a psychological construct in the paper, which I think is really important, that intelligence is a construct. It's not something we can observe directly. It's inferred. It's a theoretical abstract concept. And look, the lists are good, but what is it that binds them together? Like personality, what would we, what's personality? It's extroversion, conscientiousness, openness. It'd be like, not really. Those are dimensions of personality. What is it about the dimensions that hold them together as a concept? And that's what the definition I proposed, I think, represents at an abstract level. And so one of the key words in there is your maximal capacity. That's the most you can do at a particular time when you're motivated and you're not disturbed. So it's maximal. And the contrast with that is typical. So typical behavior is more on the side of personality. This is what people tend to do day in, day out. Intelligence is a maximal capacity. It's what you can do at your maximum under pretty good conditions. So maximum is a key word in there. And so your maximal capacity to achieve a novel goal, there's a really important word in the definition, novelty. Mm-hmm. So if a person is exposed to an IQ test repeatedly, their scores will go up. We've seen this. They're called practice effects. We've documented them over decades.
We've known them for 100 years.
Yes. So they're quite substantial. And in fact, in one of the, I'm kind of slipping into what training is, but you can easily get 10 IQ point increase just by taking the same IQ test 3, 4, 5, 6 times. In fact, some people say the Flynn effect, in part, is test savviness, that people are getting exposed to tests and they're just getting better at doing them. And it's not really their intelligence that's increasing. It's their capacity to complete any test. It could be an IQ test. It could be another type of test. So novelty is important for intelligence because one of the terms I use in the paper is intelligence is what you do when you don't know what to do, because it's been the first time you've seen it before. And how are you going to manage to solve that problem? So novelty is really important in contrast to when you have a lot of exposure, and that gets into training and achievement. So a novel goal using perceptual cognitive processes. The reason why that part of the definition has to be there is that if we're going to distinguish it from artificial intelligence, we need to think about the substrates that are mediating the performance. And in humans, I don't think it's controversial to say that we can both perceive and cognitize information. And we use the information that we get from the stimuli that we perceive, and that then we process that information, helps us to, let's say, do an IQ test or adapt to the environment. So that's, you know, I don't know if that's a long-winded answer to a question, but that is basically the key parts of the definition.
No, that helps. That helps break it down to layman's terms. I mean, we're talking about accomplishing new goals as best as you can under the best of conditions by using perception and thinking the way that humans do. And I agree with you about the laundry list, I call it, definitions. You know, I have Gottfriedson's here, which, to be fair, I've quoted before. It says intelligence is a very general mental capability that, among other things, involves the ability to reason, plan, solve problems, think abstractly, comprehend complex ideas, learn quickly, and learn from experience. It's a laundry list. And it works in telling people, here's what intelligence helps us do. But you're right. It doesn't get at the underlying ability and says, here's what is going on in someone's brain that helps them do all these things. No, it's here's what we see when it's enacted. And so that's one of the reasons why I liked your definition, is that it does get us beyond the laundry list. Instead of saying, what do the manifestations of intelligence look like? It says, what is that underlying substrate? What's that underlying trait? And so that's one of the strengths, I believe, of the article. What do you see as the commonalities, though, between something like the Gottfriedson definition, these laundry list definitions, and yours? You know, we talked about the difference. What do they have in common, though?
Well, I would say the way that we test those dimensions, when we do it validly, they represent people's maximal capacity to solve a novel problem using perceptual cognitive processes. So like a reasoning task, for example, the person ideally will not have been exposed to the items before, so it has novelty. And in a reasoning task, they're going to expend their maximal capacity, even though, you know, test-taking motivation is an issue in psychology. And my opinion is that even just reasonably good motivation will probably get you the test score that is approximately what their maximal capacity is. So I would say that the laundry list, which are all conventional abilities that are listed, so none of them are controversial, like emotional intelligence would be more of a relatively controversial dimension. So there are relatively conventional dimensions that are considered in the intelligence structure. And I would say that they meet the definition. They actually do meet the definition in practice. Okay. As examples.
Okay. No. I agree with that wholeheartedly. That makes a lot of sense. All right. So we've talked enough about human intelligence. What is it? What is it not? Let's move on to AI. In the paper, you describe artificial intelligence as, and I have the quote, an artificial system's maximal capacity to complete a novel standardized task with veridical scoring using computer algorithms. Now, I'm not a computer scientist. I'm coming at this from the psychology perspective, but already I can see you have maximal capacity there. And I can also see that you have the novelty there.
That's right.
So I see this connection between your definition of human intelligence and your definition of artificial intelligence. But what else is there that these two concepts have in common from your perspective?
And that was a major objective of the paper, was to write two definitions of intelligence that were very comparable to each other. I felt like it was necessary to do so, and I felt like it was possible to do so. And this will facilitate conversations between the two disciplines, because I don't think they're really talking to each other very much. Mm-hmm. And the definition that you just described is actually the operational definition for artificial intelligence. We provided both abstract and operational definitions, they're important to the extent that once you get to the operational definitions, you can actually work with them. And so one of the terms that you have in there is veridical scoring, which is just a fancy word for saying there is an agreed upon correct answer to the question. And that's the same for the operational definition of intelligence for humans. The only difference between the human intelligence definitions and the artificial intelligence definitions, and there's only one, it's the end, which is perceptual cognitive processes versus computational algorithms. That's the only difference between the two. And computational algorithms are, you know, in simple terms, instructions, very detailed instructions provided so that a computer can execute them. Mm-hmm. Humans don't work that way. We're on the perceptual cognitive plane.
So it's, if I understand this, if I can see some of the implications, fundamentally, the major difference is how you get there. With humans, we're getting there through these perceptual cognitive processes to solve our problems. Computers are getting there through these very sophisticated, complex algorithms to solve their problems.
That's right.
Is it possible for the outputs to be the same and humans are taking one route and computers are taking another route?
I would say almost certainly. I would say that is happening. That humans can complete an IQ test, and the LLM, I mean, large language models are mostly what we're talking about here, but the AI systems can take exactly the same IQ test and produce correct responses, but through, I would argue, fairly different processes. But the outcome's the same. And it could potentially mean the same in the sense of both of them are exhibiting intelligence, but one of them is, you know, biological and the other one's artificial.
Okay. No, that's interesting. And that brings us back to some of the questions that the computer scientists have been wrestling with for decades about things, for example, like the Turing test. Yes, we can program computers, and they have, that mimic human behavior very accurately. But you're saying that because the route's different, it's not the same, I would say, type of intelligence as what humans have. Am I correct in putting those words in your mouth?
Yeah, I would say that it would be a very difficult argument to make that humans and AI systems are engaging in exactly the same processes when they're solving a problem. I would say it's much safer bet to say that they're using different processes. Now, that doesn't, you know, just because it's different doesn't make it worse. You know, the artificial system could potentially be better. But ultimately, they can use different. I mean, even in humans that solve problems, they don't necessarily all use the same strategies when they try to solve that problem. They're all using perceptual cognitive processes. But you can see some pretty big differences in strategies when people try to solve things like block design or other types of tests. I mean, there's many, many examples of that. So, you know, you can come up with the same outcome based on different processes. And that's true for humans, true for AI. The key question, though, is that process so different in practice with AI that it actually isn't intelligence? It's actually something else. And that's the big question. And the one that's described in the paper, and a tentative conclusion is made. And we're still trying to, you know, research that and discover that.
Now let's talk about what you mentioned earlier, the artificial achievement and the related constructs. Why was it important to make this distinction?
To people who are in the human intelligence field, it's very natural for them to appreciate the distinction between achievement and intelligence. It's second nature almost to almost anybody who's in the field. But I would say to people in the computer science, it's not. And the reason why it's important, there's a couple of reasons for it. But to give you a salient example, most people have a digit span of about 6.7, as it turns out. That's, you know, people say 7 plus or minus 2, but it's really more like 6.7. And the standard deviation is about 1.3. And so, you know, very few people have a digit span of 10 or 11. It's very, you know, 1 in 1,000 might have 11. It's very, very rare.
And usually they've been trained on mnemonic devices and things like that to get there.
Maybe. I mean, you're leading into what I'm getting into. There are several documented recorded cases of humans who were pretty much just average in intelligence, who managed to increase their digit span to upwards of 100 digits. Mm-hmm. You know, people talk about alien level intelligence in computer science. To me, 100 digit span is getting at alien level intelligence.
Yeah.
But do these people really increase their intelligence? And everyone in the field of human intelligence would say almost everybody would say, no, they haven't increased their IQ. In fact, their capacity at anything else other than recalling digits to told to them in verbal format is not changed and no different. So the transference is very, very low. And in fact, if you wait months, they kind of go back to where they were. They kind of lose their training. They have to constantly keep it up. So training facilitated achievement in this case. It's about 600 hours of training, and the person managed to get their digit span to 108, the person that I described in the paper. And so that's important because that person is now not some exceptional genius. They really have achieved something. They're kind of an expert at digit span, and that's it. They're not performing better at their job in remarkable ways. They're pretty much just stuck with this one very specific achievement.
If you enjoy this conversation, like and subscribe so you don't miss another episode of the Human Intelligence Podcast. Also, leave a comment so we know what you're thinking about what we're talking about here. You can also follow us on social media at the links below. Now, back to the rest of the episode.
And so the question is, are artificial systems basically doing the same thing? Because mm-hmm. artificial systems like large language models are trained often very specifically on the test items themselves. So I talk about the Raven's progressive matrices in the paper. And they're trained, you know, very specifically on the items. And in fact, they say, you know, the 60 items in the standard progressive matrices is not enough. We need more items to train these LLMs. We need hundreds, thousands of them trained on these items. And then we'll be able to develop one that can answer questions about, you know, Raven's progressive matrices type things. And that kind of reminds me of DigitSpan, somebody who just practices DigitSpan massively. And I'm like, yeah, that's impressive. You've got, you know, kind of a party trick. But beyond that, there's not much.
Yeah. And I like the Ravens example. We have a matrix reasoning subtest on the Riot, and you can create hundreds, thousands of items in theory based on the rules that govern it. Teach a human what those rules are, and they'll very quickly be able to answer all 60 questions on the real test, and then many more. At least some humans would be able to. But it's interesting that the computers would need the thousands of items in the first place, and then they can answer more later. So it is interesting, the differences in training, and the implication between the intelligence and the achievement, and how we can train both systems to do something narrow, but it's much harder to train it to do something general.
That's correct.
Let's go back to definitions. You talk about past definitions of artificial intelligence in the paper. What are some of the problems with past definitions of artificial intelligence, and how does your definition of artificial intelligence overcome those deficiencies?
Well, some of the definitions are examples like the capacity to do a large percentage of human work. You know, it'd be something like that. And so that's one of the older ones, but it's very commonly cited. There are better ones, though. There are some definitions that I go through, like Legg and Hunter and Wang. I wouldn't say they're bad definitions, but they just don't quite get to the mark. So they don't really describe novelty enough, or they focus too much on learning, for example. So the capacity to learn is often used as a key distinguishing characteristic in artificial intelligence definitions of intelligence. And learning ability is a dimension that's considered in human intelligence, but it's just one of them. So, you know, information processing speed, memory span, fluid reasoning, visual intelligence. Intelligence is ultimately multidimensional. And so again, like trying to get to that abstract definition. The other one is the capacity to adapt to the environment. I would say some of the better definitions, and that resonates with me too, like the capacity to adapt to the environment successfully. On some level, it resonates with me. The challenge is that there are forms of adaptation that I think that are useful, but they're not examples of intelligence. And in fact, I give some really, you know, clear examples like the skin's ability to tan as response to exposure to the sun. That's an adaptive process, a very good one, but it's not intelligence.
No.
But even when you get into cognitive processes like confirmation bias, I think confirmation bias, an argument could be made that it is adaptive to engage in it, but it actually kind of reduces your intelligence when you engage in it. You know, thinking fast and thinking slow. Thinking slow is where the good quality intelligence is happening. And humans may have adapted this capacity to kind of say, well, I'm going to process some information really quickly because it's efficient, but I'm going to make mistakes. That's adaptive, but it's not good. It's not good from an intelligence perspective. So adaptation to me is not good enough to just sit on that. It's I think adaptation can be an outcome.
Well, and the evolutionary psychologist would say adaptation is a means to an end. And sometimes an adaptation that's evolved can be very harmful if the environment changes or if the organism moves into a new environment. The psychological version of that would say an adaptation like confirmation bias or some of the other heuristics that we have as humans, they evolve for a purpose and they're very useful, but change the problem and give someone a situation where confirmation bias is a negative, and now it's a maladaptive trait. So
that's right.
No, I see a lot of how the psychological perspective can inform artificial intelligence. On the other hand, I used to tell my students back when I taught as a professor, as psychologists, we're always enamored with the latest technological gizmo. If you read the earliest research on intelligence, they talk about the brain functioning like a telegraph system. And then it was a telephone switchboard. And then it was a computer. And then it was the internet. And now I'll bet you somewhere there's some psychologists out there saying that human intelligence is like an AI system. we're always thinking that the brain, we're always using the latest technology as a metaphor for the brain. And I think your paper gets us to pause on that tendency and say, wait a minute, the metaphors function as a metaphor, as a simile. There's not a one-to-one correspondence between what the machines are doing and what the humans are doing. So I love it. It's a great paper.
Good. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Let's move on to the other one about measuring intelligence. Can you summarize this study for me?
Well, this one's about measuring artificial intelligence in particular.
Yes, yes.
And it was really a paper about, computer scientists call their intelligence tests or tests, they call them benchmarks. That's the word they use. So benchmarks exist in many, many forms. There are many of them. And they have, one of them has 10,000 plus items. It's almost inconceivable to a psychometrist that we're going to make a test with 10,000 items. But they do, they kind of throw the kitchen sink at them. And the challenge, like Illich and myself wrote a first paper, the paper that we're talking about now is actually an extension of a previous paper. And, I was getting my head around these benchmarks with the help of David Illich, who's actually a computer scientist. And I was trying to understand that they're really giving them 10,000 items and, trying to look at these questions. And I was just like, we can't do a psychometric analysis in this paper because we're looking at just the structure of artificial intelligence. Is there a G factor? Are there group factors? I thought for a next paper, I'll try to shorten these tests because 10,000 items just totally unnecessary. I thought maybe we can make these tests 60 item tests. And sure enough, you know, through psychometric analyses, we're able to identify 60 good quality items across three of the subtests that we looked at, or I should say benchmarks. And the psychometrics were better than the long versions. In fact, the long forms have between 7 and 18% of their items have negative item total correlations. So the higher you score on the dimension, the less chance you are of actually getting that question right.
And for people like you and me, if we ever saw that on a test for humans, those are the first items we throw out. Or
that's right.
We look at it and say, did I screw up the key or something?
Yes.
Well, that's fact, like that is, major red flag to have that negative correlation.
That's right. Well, in fact, we know that some of the scoring key is incorrect in these tests, but it's not only scoring key. And the challenge is, how do you manage a 10,000 or even a 1,000 item test? It's so meticulous and hard work to work through that. Of course, mistakes are going to be made. So we thought, look, let's try to make these tests into 60 item tests. And they show just as good reliability. They show even better convergent validity. They're actually predict a number of parameters better than the long forms because you're having less, you know, crappy items in the total score. So there were practical reasons for developing this, for showing this paper. You know, I think AI researchers would stand to benefit by having 60 item tests. Look, I landed on 60. It could be 40. 40, 50, 60. It could be even 25. Who knows? Mm-hmm. But not 10,000. But the other reason this paper was worked upon was because I think there's a lot of scope for having AI systems and humans do exactly the same test. A human's not going to do a 10,000 item test. It's just not going to happen. No. But why, we can create 60 item tests that both humans and LLMs can do. And then we can do comparisons between the two and also try to start understanding the different processes that are associated with, you know, completing the questions. Not just comparing who's better, but trying to understand subtleties between performance and commonalities.
Yeah, and you know, you say, oh, a human's not going to do 10,000 items. I did some quick math here based on item response times on the riot. Conservatively, if you took our shortest items, 10,000, if you did 10,000 of those, that would be about 20 hours nonstop of testing. Man. An average length item, we're talking about 250 hours. You're right. No human's going to do that. Now, clearly, that's not a concern for the machine. They don't ever get tired. They can answer a question much faster than a human can. But it sounds like you're getting rid of the inversely, you know, the unhelpful items. You're getting rid of the ones with no predictive power, and you're trying to focus on the core tasks, core questions that really do produce a metric of what these machines, I don't want to say how they think, but what they can do or the problems they can solve, I think is a fair way of saying it. So that's interesting. Yeah. What can AI researchers learn about measuring artificial intelligence from psychologists? And then let's flip that. What can people like me learn from the AI researchers about measuring intelligence?
Yeah, I think probably the biggest part, and I write about this in the Defining Intelligence paper and probably the other paper as well, but I mentioned this term AI metrics. And I think the field of computer science and specifically in the AI space, they need to develop that field for themselves from which they could borrow a massive amount from psychometrics. Mm-hmm. So, you know, until in recent times, I would say there was not a lot of focus or even thought about which items should be included. How can we evaluate whether an item is good or not? You know, even something basic like item total correlations, I think we're the first to ever do it. You know, in our paper, it's the first time ever done with large language models. And the reason why is they don't really think about individual differences with large language models. We analyzed data from, I think, 561, something like that, large language models. And, you know, we could look at individual differences in run correlations in this context. AI researchers are not thinking like that yet. And I think there's a huge field for them, not just psychometrically, but the field of individual differences in humans has facilitated a lot of understanding about how people behave and how they think. I think it's conceivable that there could be an individual differences in AI systems field entirely on its own. And psychometrics is a practical application in that space. So I think, you know, if I had to say one thing that computer scientists could learn a lot from human researchers, and especially individual difference researchers, it would be psychometrics. In terms of human researchers thinking about AI, I think the biggest thing for me is that it's really forced me to think about exactly what intelligence is again. I think we kind of take for granted, you know, with Glinda Gottfredson's definition, we'd be like, yeah, that's fine. You know, it's not a, I don't want to say it's a bad definition. It's, you know, I'm sure I've cited it. It's just that, you know, once AI started to do what it started to do, it forced, you know, me at least, to think about, are they actually generating examples of intelligent behavior? And even when we get down to things like reasoning, so what exactly is reasoning? So, because there are reasoning models now, maybe you've heard of these, you know, there are specialized reasoning models. And, you know, they're surprisingly good, I suppose you could say, in some spaces. And so it's forced, I think it's forcing human researchers, especially in the intelligence space, I would encourage them to use and engage with these tools because they are interesting. And I think you would be surprised at how much it forces you to think about your own field in a deep way. And I think I would, I want to say, you know, I kind of mentioned that, you know, these systems can make mistakes, and I can speak that way to it, and that they're probably demonstrating a lot of achievement. And if there's any intelligence, it's a very narrow, specific intelligence, which sounds like I'm trying to be negative about large language models and AI, but I'm very impressed with these tools. This technology is very impressive. I'm very impressed with a lot of the people who work in this field, and they're driving it forward. I'm a user of these systems, and I'm really impressed at what they can do. So I'm a very, you know, I'm pro AI in the sense that I'm impressed by this technology and I use it myself. And it also makes surprising mistakes. And then it causes me to think about, well, what is this thing exactly? You know, how could it have made such a silly mistake when it was solving something much more complex just a minute ago? And as an intelligence researcher, it forces you to think about it.
I would agree on all those wholeheartedly. I appreciate your thoughts. I appreciate you coming on to the podcast. This is Gilles Gignac, from the University of Western Australia. And the two papers we've been talking about are Defining Intelligence, Bridging the Gap Between Human and Artificial Perspectives, and Psychometrically Derived 60-Question Benchmarks, Substantial Efficiencies and the Possibility of Human-AI Comparisons. And we'll provide links to those papers. And I highly recommend that our viewers and our listeners take the time to read those and check them out. Anyway, thanks for coming on the show. And I hope you have a great day.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
If you enjoyed this conversation, like or subscribe to our podcast. Also, check out our premiere episode with guest Yvonne Krupin to talk about executive functioning. See you next time.